So this is where we've come so far. This is the ground that we've covered so far. This is the material which we have surveyed. And I think you will have agreed with me that in the course of our seven lectures we have surveyed a very rich, a very vital, a very dramatic field in a way, and covered a very great deal of ground. Now, having come so far, we have to go a little further. Today, we come to our eighth and our last lecture, which is entitled The Future of Tibetan Buddhism. Now, I'm sure that this thought is very much in the minds of many of you, having heard about the wonders and the glories of Tibetan Buddhism, after hearing about all these great traditions, these great spiritual disciplines, these great masters, these very learned monks, this wonderfully highly organized monastic life, when one contemplates this spectacle, as it were, of a whole country organized around or geared to religion, this is very, very inspiring and very wonderful in a way. And it is this which we saw in the case of Tibet, that other countries have had their whole national life, their whole national organization geared either to commerce or to politics or to conquest or to the arts. But in the case of Tibet, the whole of life, economic life, social life, political life, artistic life, was all geared ultimately to religion, as we saw in some detail at the beginning in the first lecture. So naturally we cannot help wondering, what is going to happen to this system? What is going to happen to Tibetan Buddhism? What is its future? It has such a glorious past, has such a wonderful, such an enthralling past. The past of Tibetan Buddhism has so many lessons to teach us. But what about the future? One can't just rest contented with the past or even with the present. The human mind naturally looks forward to the future. So we want to know what is going to happen to Tibetan Buddhism. What is happening to Tibetan Buddhism? What is its future? So this is the question which stands as the title of our lecture today, The Future of Tibetan Buddhism. But I'm afraid, having given this title, having asked what is the future of Tibetan Buddhism, I'm sorry to say that we have to face at once, and we might as well face it at once, we have to face a very unpalatable fact. And that is that so far as human eye can see, Tibetan Buddhism has in fact no future. It has had a very glorious past, but so far as we can see, it has, we must confess, with regret, no future. In other words, the system as we know it, the system as it has existed in Tibet for hundreds upon hundreds of years, this great system, this great form of Buddhism, in its integrity, in its fullness, in its completeness, has no future. This is the first fact which we must allow to sink in, which we have to accept, to which we have to come to terms. In Tibet itself, if we remember, there were many ancient prophecies. I remember myself sometimes being told by Tibetan friends in Kalimpong that there were many ancient prophecies current from early times about Buddhism in Tibet, about the future of Tibetan Buddhism, about the Dalai Lama, and so on. And one of these prophecies, which was quoted very much among Tibetans just a few years ago, was to the effect that the 14th Dalai Lama, the 14th of this very distinguished line, would be the last. So we may say that in a sense, Tibetans, especially learned Tibetans, Tibetans who were versed in the history and the traditions of their own country and their own religion, were not surprised when the Dalai Lama in 1959 had to flee from Tibet and seek refuge as a refugee in India. They were not surprised. They started saying among themselves, it's unfortunate, it's a tragedy, but it has been prophesied that the 14th Dalai Lama will be the last. And this, of course, does not just mean that everything will be the same in Tibet, except that you'll no longer have a Dalai Lama. This is impossible. It's like saying, well, the queen bee may not be there, but the life of the hive will go on. That's impossible. because the Dalai Lama was, and to some extent still is, very much the queen bee, as it were, if I may use such an expression, of the hive of Tibetan Buddhism. The Dalai Lama is central to the whole system. The Dalai Lama summarizes, as it were, embodies in his person the whole of Tibetan Buddhism. If the Dalai Lama goes, well, in a sense, I won't say everything goes, but the system as we know it, or the system as we have known it in Tibet for so many hundreds of years, this system does go. So, according to these prophecies, as I've said, the 14th Dalai Lama will be the last, and it does really seem that he will be the last, and that the whole system, the whole way of life, which he represents, which he embodies, which he incarnates, if you like, will come to an end. Since 1950, Tibet, we know, has been under Chinese domination. I remember, if I may strike a personal note, I remember that year 1950 very, very vividly. I was at that time in Kalimpong. I just arrived. I arrived in Kalimpong in the month of March, and all during that summer there were wars and rumors of war, as it were, from Tibet, from the borderlands between Tibet and China, and we learned that the Chinese armies were on the march. We learned that they were building roads, that they were bringing up reinforcements. We heard, first of all, that they had entered Kham in eastern Tibet. We heard that monasteries had fallen, that monks had been massacred. And then week by week, month by month, we watched, almost breathless, one may say, we watched them advance ever nearer and nearer and nearer to the sacred city of Lhasa. And eventually, they were there. The Chinese communists were in Lhasa. And when they reached Lhasa, it was as though, for many people, the end of an epoch had come. So they have been there in Tibet. The Chinese communists have been in Tibet for the last 18 years. 18 years is quite a long time. 18 years is time enough, we may say, for a whole new generation to have grown up in Tibet. And during this period, many, many changes have taken place. Material changes have taken place. Some of them, we must admit, we must confess, for the better. Roads have been laid down, hospitals have been built, schools have been opened, and we may say that on the whole, perhaps, the material lot of the people probably has been improved. And also, great psychological changes have taken place during these 18 years in the outlook of the Tibetan people, especially the younger people. This is partly due, no doubt, to Marxist, or rather to Maoist indoctrination, but not altogether. It's partly due to this psychological change which has come over, and which is coming over the Tibetan people, especially the younger people. It's partly due also to the inevitable march of time. What has in fact happened is that the Industrial Revolution has at last caught up with Tibet. First of all, Europe succumbed. Asia has largely succumbed, is in process of succumbing, and Tibet, we may say, was the last major civilization of the old type, the last civilization of the traditional type to succumb to this onrush of industrialism. If we just look back, we will see that in some parts of Tibet, within living memory, within the last 15, 20 years, they didn't even have the wheel. There were no wheeled vehicles. There were no carts in some parts of Tibet. Now, I'm not saying that that mattered very much. You can live perfectly well without wheels. But technologically, it meant that some parts of Tibet were still in the Stone Age. And this was only 15 or 20 years ago. Now, not only do they have the wheel, they have the wheel in some of its most complicated forms. They have the motor car and they have the aeroplane. People who just a few years ago didn't even have an ordinary wheel. So this has resulted, we may say, in a tremendous cultural shock. Perhaps we can't appreciate the force of this. Supposing you yourself were living say at the time of the Norman conquest. Just imagine how you would have been living at that time. Now just imagine that you were sort of incarnated, that you were born at that particular epoch, the time of the Norman conquest. And suppose you were living in your village with your priest, with your farm work, and so on. And suppose suddenly by some sort of marvel, by some sort of miracle, you were snatched up from the middle of the 11th century and you were plonked down in the middle of the 20th. Well, what sort of shock you would experience when you saw things so different, so industrialized, so mechanized, everything different. And this is, in a way, what has happened to many of the Tibetan people. That they've been lifted up from a very simple, though spiritually profound, type of civilization and landed right in the middle of the 20th century, exposed to all the technological and materialistic winds that blow. This is what has happened. And in many ways, it is a very great pity. It's a very great pity that Tibet, the traditional culture of Tibet, has been disrupted, has been broken up in this way. But great a pity as it is, we can be pretty sure that it would have happened anyway, even if the Chinese had not invaded Tibet. It might have happened in a less dramatic manner, but it would inevitably have happened. I remember in this connection seeing myself so many times in Kalimpong, young Tibetans, fresh from Tibet, fresh very often from Lhasa. And I've seen this many and many a time. When you first see them, when you first meet them, they're obviously new arrivals. After all, you can always spot the new arrival because he looks around him, he looks about him, and he takes notice of things that you would take for granted. I remember the first time I took a party of Tibetan students of mine to Darjeeling. They were very, very fascinated by the railway station and the railway engine because they'd never seen one before. And to them, it was just like a great iron dragon. And they were men of about 40, all of them, but they were fresh. They were newly arrived, and they hadn't seen a locomotive before. So I took them onto the Darjeeling railway station platform, and there was what to them would appear a great monster standing beside the platform. It was a very tiny little engine, actually, because the railway which goes up to the hills is called the Toy Himalayan Railway. It was very, very tiny indeed, but they were very much impressed by this. And they were very excitedly looking at it and peering underneath it and tapping the wheels and just chatting among themselves and gesticulating and wondering what it was all about. And suddenly it let out a great hoot. And they sprang back wondering what was going to happen, whether it was going to bite them or something of that sort. And they were very, very interested indeed. So in this way, I remember a lot of Tibetans, young Tibetans especially, coming to Kalimpong, freshly arrived from Tibet, from Lhasa. And at first, you see, they were typically Tibetan. They wore, first of all, their hair long. The Tibetan males traditionally wear their hair long. And then they tie it all into a braid, and the braid goes round their head. And of course, if they're of good family, they wear a long earring, usually a turquoise. And then, of course, they'd be wearing their Tibetan dress, which was a sort of a chuba, a sort of dressing gown-like affair, and tall boots. And they probably have a very swashbuckling sort of appearance. And, of course, they'd have a rosary in their hand, every single Tibetan. So this is what one will see. This would be the sort of picture that one saw when these young Tibetans, some of 18, 20, 21, would come first of all to Kalimpong. And mind you, Kalimpong is just a little town. It's 15,000 inhabitants. It's rather backward from the standpoint of people living in London. Not everybody in Kalimpong has electricity and running water and all the rest of it. It's a very simple, very quiet little place. So you wouldn't think that there was much there or many influences there to corrupt the innocent young Tibetan. But just wait. Just wait for 6 months and then take another look at those same young Tibetans. And I've done this myself many and many a time. See them after 6 months and you find they're completely changed. No one has changed them. It's just happened. They've cut off their long hair. That usually goes first. They become crew cut. And then they start wearing, they're very fond of this sort of thing, shark skin suits. Huh? And then they give up their rosary, and you see they're carrying around a transistor set. Huh? So this is what happens. Huh? And then you find they get interested in pop music, they want to learn to dance the twist and all that sort of thing. And these are young Tibetans who 6 months before had been living in the Middle Ages. So we mustn't think it's all due to the Chinese, we mustn't think it's all due to the communists. This is the march of time. It may not be progress, I'm sure in a way it isn't progress, it's change. And this change happens inevitably. And Tibet, I'm sorry to say, even had the Chinese not come to Tibet, Tibet also would have undergone this sort of process. It's interesting, incidentally, to observe that my remarks apply only to young Tibetan males. The women, even the young women, seem to be much more conservative. You don't see them cutting their hair, and you don't see them changing their dress. They may give up their rosaries and prayer wheels, but they don't go much further than that. In fact, one may say that, anthropologically speaking, it's a well-known fact that culturally, the male is the much less stable sex. The female is the much more stable sex where any question of culture or religion and so on is concerned. So in the case of these young Tibetans coming to Kalimpong, there's no question of Chinese communist influence. It just happened. It was, as it were, inevitable. So therefore we may say that even if Tibet does succeed, as one hopes Tibet will succeed, in regaining independence, if they manage to shake off the Chinese, whether communist or non-communist, control, if the Dalai Lama returns to Tibet and takes up his residence again in the Potala, it will still be impossible to put the clock back. Tibet, we may say, will never be again what it was before, what it was for so many hundreds of years. And it's in this sense that I say that Tibetan Buddhism has no future. Now, we shouldn't be too much upset by this. It's a very great loss, no doubt. But as Buddhists, or as students of Buddhism at least, we have to remember that the law of change, anicca, governs and dominates and controls all human affairs whatsoever. And we must remember that the institutional forms of Buddhism itself are no exception to this law. Buddhism began in India. The Buddha lived and taught in India. And Indian Buddhism endured for 1500 years. But in the end, it disappeared. So that nowadays, apart from a few modern revivals, we do not find in India any trace, any longer, of Buddhism. So that being the case, one should not be surprised if Buddhism was to disappear from Tibet after a similar period.